After we got home, dried off, and were fed a delicious meal by Susan and Mark, we sat out on the porch during a June thunderstorm to listen to some of Susan's reflections on the Big A Dam fight, her time in the West Branch of the Penobscot, and her connection to this community. We also got to talk with Mark a little bit about his childhood and how he met Susan. Spoiler alert, they've been together since they were 16 or 17 years old, depending on who's telling the story.
So right now, we're sitting right on the Mount Chase Patton border in a building that Elliottsville Foundation purchased a couple of years ago as kind of a base for us, a base of operations up here in this region.
It's kind of like a farmhouse, log cabin.
Yeah, farmhouse with lots of garages and barns for equipment and things like that, and lots of space, outdoor space, green space. It's surrounded by these awesome 115 fruit trees that local students helped us plant for orchards. And it's got a little pond. We've had kids on learning how to paddle boards and canoes. And it's got disc golf that keeps Mark happy. And we've had other local people come over and play golf, disc golf with us. It's nice. It's been a kind of a really nice gathering place for people in the area. Nice. And in the region, actually, they'll come up from Millinocket and stuff too. We had a little concert here recently, even a little impromptu concert.
So. Nice. I'm interested in this connection because when I talked to Sandy Neely, she talked about the Big A Dam, you know, which was this proposed hydro dam that would flood one of the most beautiful stretches of whitewater river in the state of Maine, the Ripogenus Gorge. And so she was really involved in that. But you were there too because mm-hmm. you knew Sandy. So yeah, just talk a little bit about that time and what you're doing. You were taking people out on the river.
Yeah, it was. I learned so much from Sandy Neely. I mean, I can't say enough about her and what she did to save something that's so, I mean, it's going to make me cry, so special to myself and my family and my son. Even growing up, he'll never ever forget it. He's a river boy. And we lived there in that area after that for the next 30 years in the summers. We ran our business and had our family and our life there. And it was because of people like Sandy Neely that spoke up in a very grassroots movement. And my little part that I played in that grassroots movement was to, I got to take people down the river in the rafts and talk to them about what would be lost if this happened. And it was also, I think I had some friends from Millinocket and everything. I knew a lot of people and I had that connection as well. So I knew what was going on kind of a little bit on both ends mm-hmm. emotionally.
So who you're taking on? It wasn't just average people, it was
people that could make a difference.
Yeah.
People that would speak up and make a difference or bring their organization to the table. The Big A fight was a huge collaborative of people that didn't necessarily want the same similar outcomes or have the same reasons for being there and preventing the Big A from being built. But I mean, some people it was just like enough's enough. There were 19 dams at that time on the Penobscot River. Why do we need one more? Why don't we make others more efficient? It's so funny because if only it had that crystal ball of looking down the road and everything, you know, and then the Penobscot Restoration Project since then has happened and they've actually removed dams and created more efficient dams and things like that. So we didn't have to lose all that. But what if? And we didn't win. I was out actually, this is another little off story, but we were out canvassing people to talk to them about the National Monument. You know, when you go out to and I'd never canvassed before, and when you go out to canvass in the region, they think they've selected people, I think, for you that they feel like will be supportive, but you really don't know when you knock on that door who you're going to speak to. So when I knocked on the door with this guy, and I was with an intern that was with me, and it was my first or second person to talk to, and somehow we explained to him why we were there and stuff like that, and he got really angry and he goes, "You people," he's like, "it's because of you that we don't have, and the Big A, that, you know, we don't have our mill anymore," and things like that. And I just went, like, I was just like taken aback. And he goes, "it's something about you winning that fight or something like that." And I said, "well, we didn't win. There was a whistleblower." I said, "we actually lost that fight. They don't, like, some people don't even understand the facts of how mm-hmm. that all came out. We were that close. We were like, so close to that dam being built." And one person behind the scenes stood up
And how did that play out? Because that's, I mean, that's...
There was a water quality standard, I believe, they couldn't make. I think it was temperature or something like that. And it had been changed, and people went kind of behind the scenes and tried to change things after the fact. Like rules and regulations. Mm-hmm. And there was a whistleblower. And it was just... So that brave person, and then Sandy basically giving up her life for 5 years, and, you know, being so articulate in how she writes and everything as well, and getting that across. And then her, it's like she couldn't send out an email chain to everybody to get them to come to these meetings and things like that. It had to be word of mouth and phone calling and things like that. And so it was huge. And fishermen, hunters, recreationalists, kayakers, paddlers, and just environmentalists as a whole and things like that coming together. My little teeny part I played was, I did a little bit of some background research here and there, but basically somebody would say, you have a group you're taking down today, talk to them about, I mean, we talked to every single customer we took down the river, yeah, about the Big A. I did.
But these
I
are would people drive, like, they could be elected officials or like donors,
they, yes,
or
exactly. They could be
head
anybody.
Of organizations or
mostly a lot of head of organizations and things like that, but people, yeah, that could write letters and make a difference, because by then it was people to speak that needed. They needed to hear from everybody how much everybody cared. But I didn't go by Big Eddie once in that tree with a raincoat way up at 300 feet or whatever without pointing it out to every single person, no matter who they were or why they were there. But they were just there to recreate and play. I mentioned that to them.
Hold on, what's the raincoat in the tree?
Oh, sorry. The raincoat in the tree. So Matt Holstein, I believe it was, climbed up to the top of this big pine tree at Big Eddie down below the gorge
in
the crypt.
A spot in the river.
A spot in the river. And said, this is the height that the lake will be at if they build the Big A project down the road,
and
down the
like
river.
300 feet above the river bottom.
You know, if it's 300, but it's a couple hundred feet above or whatever. It would be a lake.
Yeah.
We would be in a lake and those would be underwater.
Yeah.
Much like other lakes in Maine. There's quite a few of them like that in Maine already. And I just felt like I should put that out to every single person in my life.
Yeah.
It was yellow. It was really faded by the time that tree fell down. I was there many, many years later when the tree came down and found the raincoat as well. But it was... I feel like you should point that out to everybody, not just them, because you never know who that person knows that might tell someone else.
Yeah.
And then, you know, what, 35 years, 40 years, even more, years later, we're driving people around, showing them what could potentially be a new national park unit. That was kind of the same thing all over again.
Yeah.
You know, you're showing people, like, this is what could be, only this time we're showing them the potential of, okay, it's already been logged, its use has been done, you know, it's done now for the next 40 years or whatever. What can we create of this 87,564 acres of land? And how about we keep this chunk for future generations? And, you know, there's parts of it that we can do demonstrative logging in, which educational, which I think is amazing, because that is embedded in this area up here. Logging is at some point or other. It's not the huge crews of people that it used to be. It's incredibly talented people operating these machines like Game Boys or whatever, but that's really simplification. But they're amazing what they have to be able to do, and the skill level now they're looking for people to do.
Yeah,
that.
I've seen the controls on them,
yeah,
and they're way more complicated than Game Boys.
Oh,
if they were
yeah.
that simple, it'd be a lot easier.
They're crazy, but they've cut down the number of people needed and then
yeah.
somebody to truck this stuff
yes.
out and things like that, but it's still very much a part of it all, you know? We even logged, before it became a national monument, we logged for rough grouse habitat. And we brought in the Rough Grouse Society and had them advise us on it and everything. And that's for hunting and for wildlife. So
I just find it interesting and notable that you were there in these two kind of big stories in Maine history, in Maine conservation history. And you and Mark were the ones that were there on the, like, giving people the experience to show them the consequences
yeah.
of what either you're trying to stop or what could potentially happen with the National
Monument.
We
were fortunate, yeah, to be able to do that. But, I just think of myself as like the worker bee, the behind the scenes. I like that position, like kind of being there. This is weird. The only reason I'm doing this is there's no camera. It's that. But it's like that behind the scenes. You really feel like you're doing something, but it takes a special person like the Sandys and the Lucases to stand up there in front of people. That takes a lot of guts.
Yeah.
And to be, you know, be able to be sharp enough to respond to people and think about what's going to work best with this person, how is this approach How can I make them understand at least and think about? You don't want to try to change people.
Yeah.
You want to try to help them think about and have all the facts in front of them. Mm-hmm. And I had a gentleman just during the vaccination clinics that came up to me that I knew was a staunch opponent of the National Monument, National Park, and everything, had the signs and everything. And after 8 years, and I've always known him and had a good relationship with him and everything, and come up to me, and he doesn't speak much, and he said, I like the park. It hasn't hurt me one bit. And to have this older gentleman that's quiet and say that to me, I was glad I had a mask on, because he couldn't see my jaw drop. It was wonderful.
And my guess is that him saying that was not about admitting defeat or I was wrong. It was more about your personal relationship with him. Like, he wanted you to know what he thought, because you have a relationship.
He shared that with me, and that shouldn't be part of our... We can continue to agree to disagree on everything, but or anything, or have different outlooks on life and politics and everything else.
But it says something about you that he valued your relationship enough, that you and he had enough that he wanted you to know that.
Yeah, and that's when you live here on the land and you live in the communities with those people and things like that.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool. It's like our friends that we have from Millinocket that worked for the mill for years and things like that. So many of them, I don't think, really wanted that, but it was like, if that's what you have to do to survive, or that's what you need, or your life, or whatever, then that's what you do. Mm-hmm. And you can't ever hold that against anybody.
Yeah.
You're missing out on some good people, man.
Yeah, and it's also, those people are sort of at the end of the line, so to speak, of all the big investment money and decision making.
Oh, yeah.
About, you know, what resource gets exploited.
Exactly.
They're the ones, you know, there's jobs and they need to make a living, and that's what it is.
I always feel like in these, and maybe this is just me personally and my take on it all, but when there's an environmental issue or something like that, the opponents are the ones that will go for those people and find their weak spots and use that. And I don't think that's right, but that's the way they do it.
Yeah. I've seen that many times.
You know, and maybe we're the goody two-shoes that just can't do that. I always feel like you need to be honest with people no matter what. And I'm always like, in all of this, I always didn't want to say anything to anybody that I knew couldn't be true or wouldn't come true. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'm still ready to fight for anything if it doesn't come true for those people, because I made a promise to them.
You know, it strikes me that, you know, the other commonality, you know, Big A and the monument are the river. One was the west branch of the Penobscot, and one is the east branch of the Penobscot.
Yep. It's that tributary means so much to me, that watershed, because I grew up at the bottom of it, right in Penobscot Bay. It was my other special place from birth on. My mother's family was from there. Grew up in a little tiny town that's not even a town anymore, called Sandy Point, Maine. And we watched our clam flats get closed off when we were little, you know, and told the water was getting too polluted to spend a lot of time in there, and you could see the degradation of it and the quality. You'd go down to places like Belfast, Maine, and see they were disgusting and what we were doing. And then it had something to do with the Everglades too, I think, or the loss of habitat in Florida as well. Somewhere back there in the early 70s that I decided to go into environmental studies, because it's just like, look what we're doing, all this development.
Sometimes I think about the East Branch and the West Branch, or it has occurred to me. I picture two hands holding something precious, the mountain, the Taten.
Yeah, ooh, that's very good.
West Branch being the left hand and the East Branch being the right hand, and the mountain's in the middle, it gets cradled by the... I don't know if that's the right way to look at it, but there's something about the two branches of the river kind of cradle the mountain.
Yeah, I think you're right. The mountain's always been a really centering thing for me. I mean, every day at work, when I'd go to work on the river, I could look out and see Katahdin. And then to move over here, we saw Katahdin from a new and different angle.
Yeah.
But it's like there's a time in your life you need this. And we were way too old to be making a change like that. But it just felt right to do it and come over. And it was kind of exciting, too.
Yeah,
it's fun. It's really neat. And meeting new people all the time. And when you live up in a rural area, you know, you don't have that, like, I don't know, I call it the coffee shop thing, where you, when I go to a town or city, we love to get a seat by the window and watch people.
Yeah.
Because there's not a lot of people to watch out here and things like that. So it was really fun to meet new people from all over. I mean, who gets to meet? It's like met like a couple of secretaries of the interior now. Met some Secret Service guys. They're really cool. You know, gotten to know some of our legislators, the people that work for us out there better, and a better understanding of them.
So senators, members of Congress.
Yeah, from the state level and the national and the federal, level. Yeah, from all over. New Mexico, and they've stayed right here with us, and they're all real people. I gotta say my fave has gotta be Secretary Jewell. She will always be my favorite, but you think of them as these political figures, and do they really care? You don't know them. Mm. You know, you hear about their policies and things like that, but you don't really know until you meet them. And some of them are great, and some of them are not people you'd bother to have dinner with again or something.
And Secretary Sally Jewell, so she was Secretary of Interior under Barack Obama.
Yes.
And, I mean, she was right at home in the outdoors.
Oh, yes. She was so comfortable, and she was so gracious. That was her big thing. Like, I mean, of course, every time you do something when they travel somewhere, there's so much press and everything. And she was so polite to the point that this is me, Ms. Mom or whatever, but she wouldn't be eating. And so I, like, stick a sandwich in underneath her, put food under her, because I knew she hadn't had time to eat anything. And you're out there canoeing or hiking or whatever, you got to have some energy and... So it's like more you want to care for them so they can do their job, because what they're doing is huge, because they're getting the word out to everybody about your mission or what you want to see done. So, and Mark's great about, he speaks so much less than I do, but when he speaks to people, listen, he loves to tell them stories and things like that. So he's kind of likable.
How would you describe the National Monument and what it has to offer? So someone just flies in here, they just get transported from Minnesota or California, and you've got 30 seconds to describe to them what's here.
Wow. Well, the woods and waters says it all. I mean, it is woods and waters. For me, like yesterday, it was a hot day. I chose the river. But there's some beautiful hiking. There's places you can walk. Make sure you take enough time that you don't just sit in your car and drive around. And I know this is something that Park Service struggles with all the time, is people who just want to drive a loop road or something like that. I guarantee you, you may or may not, depending on where you're from, you know, be impressed with driving the loop road. I know if you can see everything and it's clear, there will be these amazing aha moments. But if you really stop and get out and take these short little walks and things like that and spend some time in that quiet solitude and have patience, you'll see so much more, and it will give you so much more back. But you have to be willing to take that moment and do it. And then you have to be able to look to the future, too. When you look at a lot of these lands, the lands that were purchased to become the new National Monument, a majority of them have been logged over long enough ago that it's all green no matter what now, but the big trees and things like that, they'll all come back. It'll be the Wissahickon Valley. Can you imagine that, with the big huge king pines that used to be there and things like that? It will come back, not in our generation, but you've got great grandchildren, they'll be able to come back and see something just amazing. Mm-hmm. We've got to give credit to the people that do this sort of thing, this philanthropy, like Roxanne did and the Rockefellers did in the past, and the Carnegies and people like that. But, you know, Roxanne seeing that we needed to set a piece aside, and she didn't have the grandchildren then that she has now. She can pass this on to her grandchildren, but all of us will benefit from it.
Yeah.
And if only more people would do that. I think I was telling you the other day how frustrated I get when I see people and they but the biggest yacht in the world, or they have these McMansions, these giant mansions or whatever. It's like, wow, what if they had just taken a couple bedrooms out and they had donated that money to preserving some of this? Mm. You know, it would have been just amazing. It's mind-blowing what people could do.
You talked about Big Eddy Campground.
Mm-hmm.
And can you, like, what is Big Eddy? Because that's a... People are going to be like, who's Big Eddy?
Oh, I know. Oh, man, what is Big Eddy? T-shirt.
And what's the campground?
There's a great t-shirt from back when we were rafting called I Dig Big Eddy, and it's this woman with a helmet on, you know, a voluptuous woman. And I was going to name it. Big Eddy. Big Eddy is an eddy in the river. An eddy is a when you have white water or water flowing down a river and there's a rock or an object or a part of the land that sticks out, there'll be an eddy behind it. It's the place where you could always stop and rest when you were in your kayak and you needed to catch your breath or something like that. You go pulling behind an eddy. The big eddy is huge. It's one of the larger eddies on the west branch of the Penobscot River, and the fish love it. It was a great place to put a campsite long ago. Mark's great. He remembers going camping with his grandfather there when it was just a little pull off beside the road. And they go fishing, and when there were log drives, all the bugs would be falling off the logs, and there'd be huge salmon in there, and it's cool. And then later on, when we were living there, we would do what was called the circuit. My friend taught me this. My friend Martha taught me about the circuit. And you'd put your life jacket on at the end of a hard day, and you'd jump in, and an eddy moves back up river. And so, and then you can swim out into the current, and you'll flow down river. And then you can swim back in a little bit, and you flow up river. And you would do this circuit around and around with your life jacket on, sometimes with your beverage of choice at the end of a hard day. And it was just wonderful. And we taught so many kids later on when Chiwanki came and bought the property, and we started working with Chiwanki. We taught these kids about doing the swimming the circuit. And it's a wonderful way to understand the river and its currents, too, because you feel it. You can feel it with your feet hanging down, your legs, and things like that, too. So it was, and anyway, that's why that's the big eddy. It's down right below the Cribworks Rapid, which is a large class 5 gorgeous rapid that's been changed a little bit. Man changed it. White man changed it by dynamite and things like that. And above that is Ripogenus Gorge, which also has a man-made feature at the top of it that creates that whole river, which is Ripogenus Dam. So, and the lakes beyond that are beautiful. We spend a lot of time on Rip Lake and Chesuncook Lake. And my son did growing up, so, and the river. He literally grew up beside the river. He lived in a tent. We were migrant workers. We would do seasonal forever. I told you, we were oppies. We are oppies now. We were yoppies back then, but now we're oppies. Old outdoor poor professionals. Recreation isn't going to get you rich, for the most part, unless you become Yvon Chouinard or someone like that. And look what he did. Mm-hmm. I mean, that would be, for me, the inspiration for getting rich. I remember my mom always telling me, she goes, I want to win the Mega Bucks or lottery. I'm like, why do you buy lottery tickets? She goes, I want to win it because I want to give it all away. Mm. And to me, that was like a really important lesson. That, and she was always volunteering and always telling people to give back. That was a big thing. She never had, she had a couple little businesses, but mostly she volunteered her whole life. And
so you and Mark worked at the campground that was right at the beginning.
We did. We had a photo business for many, many years, whitewater photography business. It was fun because we worked for the Sandy's Rafting Company for a while. And then one day, and we started shooting photos for them. Or I did a little bit, and then Mark was doing more. And then I got pregnant and couldn't really kayak anymore after that or work very well that next year. Or was trying to figure out how I could still work on the river, I think was it. I didn't want to leave. And Mark was riding with over with John, the rafting company owner, in the van one day, or riding back, and he said, how about if I, you know, just start shooting photos and you contract me? They worked out a deal. And from that, it grew from one company to two to three to, there were some days we shot 10 companies. And we hired another person to work with us.
So you're on the shore taking a photo of a raffle of people going down and all, like,
in key spots.
Yes.
So there were logistics, like, incredible. When you have 10 rafting companies and you want to shoot them at least two spots on the river. Ooh, nice thunder. And you want to shoot them in at least two spots on the river. Action spots.
Yeah.
It's challenging because you've got to get cut. You've got to get there. Some of them are on one side of the river that's not road accessible or whatever. For me, the challenge became even more. I had a six-week-old I started working with. Yeah. So, and some of it was climbing down into Ripogenus Gorge, you know, a 100-foot gorge or whatever. And we had to get down on the ledges or wherever, or get down in there. I started working with a dog after my son got a little bit older, so I could put the dog and him in the kayak with me. But.
And then you would develop the photos and sell them to the people, and they could take home a photo, or you would send it to them. Or.
At first, Mark's got a good story about one time he's like doing it. Oh, they're heating things up over the fire and stuff like that. But we finally got a little camper, I think, that we could do the chemicals in and stuff like that that way. But yeah, our dark room was a dark bag, basically, and stuff like that.
You're developing the photos?
Oh, yeah, over the fire. Mark only did that a couple times. That was not easy to do because there's certain temperatures you had to reach and things like that.
Oh, my goodness.
And then we started doing it on the stove in this little camper and things like that. But yeah. And then we went to C-41, which was so nice. So we worked with the guy that was doing all the print work over in the Forks, Albert Marinelli. He was awesome. And he bought a C-41 machine, and we could run it off the generator at Big Eddie when it ran, as long as it ran. The big thing was to show a slideshow to the people at the end of the day that went rafting. They would buy prints. They would sell the prints, whatever. The hard part was we had to shoot on a duping stand these photos, and if anybody stepped into the thing, the trailer would shake, and so you'd have to reshoot them. You'd have blur. And it was so funny, and people were always yelling at each other. And we'd get in there, and there'd be four or five of us in there, and some raft guide would come in and start chit-chatting and eating our food or helping themselves to the beer in the little fridge or whatever, and you'd have to start over again. We found some old footage. I had a bunch of old footage made up. We had a video camera for a while, and there's one of, you can tell, they had the lens cap on, and somebody must have pushed the button by accident, but you could tell somebody had their, my son, as a little boy, had his hands in the dry bag, or no, one of the guys we were working for. And my son, who's like 8 years old, trying to tell the guy whose hands are inside the dark bag what to do and everything, to load new film. I think it was a bulk roll of film or something he was reloading and stuff. Just so funny, this 8-year old telling that. And since then, my son has become, he's a really good kayaker, but he also loves to take really beautiful photos and things. And he worked for us on the river for a while, too. Wow. So.
Water kind of plays a theme in your life.
I love the desert. It's really funny. I love New Mexico. My son lived there for a while, and we'd go out there and spend, you know, a couple weeks at a time out there mountain biking and stuff. But I appreciate it all, but then I come home and I appreciate this. I appreciate the rain. I love the rain. I love the water. I love the winter and the cold months. I don't get why people go to Florida. I like the Everglades, though. My grandfather taught me about the Everglades. He would go and camp a month in the winter down there, and there's a little pop-up camper, my grandmother and grandfather, and we'd spend time down there. Mm-hmm. I think that was my first big national park other than Acadia I went to, was, now that I think about it, the Everglades National Park. So, and I could see the reason for that. But yeah, water, totally.
Yeah.
I love it.
And then you're on the board of Maine Lakes.
Yes.
And, like, I guess there's lakes around here. You don't have
This all is part of it, though.
Yeah.
It's raining right now here, and it's headed somewhere. Well, maybe not right now. It's so dry, but yeah. So I feel like they're all tied together. I mean, we almost need a Maine water kind of thing, or a Maine resources group. Natural Resources Council of Maine does that kind of. Because I always said, why is there a Maine Lakes and a Maine River and LEA and all those different ones? Why can't we all work together? Mm-hmm. And we do now. And actually, our new director at Maine Lakes is, they've been gathering together more some of the associations, but also like the Maine River, she's meeting, they're doing little collaborative meetings once a month or something where they talk and see how they can help work together to protect everything. Nice. Now it's really going to rain.
Where's Mark? We should have him come out and
having his coffee. We can get him. I'll go grab him. You want to go inside?
Yeah. With Susan, we talked about going back to Big Eddie and Big A, the monument. I mean, you guys have been partners doing this stuff for a long, long time. So I guess, you know, to ask you a different question, I guess starting with the monument work over the last, you said, 9 years?
Yeah.
What sticks with you that you really enjoyed or you felt like really mattered?
I think meeting people in this region. It was funny when we came. It's like we came from the other side of the mountain, you know, when we were over in the West Branch.
Yeah.
And the kind of having grown, kind of really grown up in that area, climbing the mountain as a kid, and my father, we fished there all the time. And then coming not that far away over to the East Branch, and it's like a whole new territory. I didn't know anything, you know, like, and learning about the whole region and meeting all the people up here, and, you know, and another beautiful area, so close. But people would say, you know, where did you come from? So I go, just the other side of that mountain there. The West Branch over to the East Branch. So that was a big part of it. It's just the fun of learning a new area and a new river, where all the rocks are in the new river and whatnot.
So talk about growing up. You know, where did you grow up, and how did you first start forming a relationship with
the river and the mountain in this area?
I grew up in Orrington, which is outside of Brewer, Bangor. My dad was into the outdoors as a, he was a kid. I don't think my grandparents were that. My grandfather liked to fish, but he just loved being outside. And we have photos of him from the 50s climbing Sugarloaf, you know, in all army surplus ski gear and whatnot. And he just loved to ski, and he loved to fish, and, you know, loved to paddle. And so it really, really came from him. That's what we did. I mean, we fished in the summer. We hunted in the fall. We skied all winter. That's what he loved. I mean, I climbed Katahdin for the first time when I was 8 and cried a lot of the way. I got to the top and started snowing. I don't believe they even let kids that young technically climb the mountain anymore. But we did the first time. But he also worked at Camp Natarsui when he was a young man, helping guide and whatnot up there.
What is that?
So it was a Girl Scout camp right before you get into Baxter.
Yeah, I didn't know the
Susan
name.
Went there as a kid, and mm-hmm. she was a counselor, and her mother went there, and my father's sister, my aunt, went there, and it's a long history. It's a beautiful spot. Still is now. We went back last year and showed some friends and hiked around and heard some memories of her growing up there. But yeah, it was Dad. It was, you know, he had a passion for the outdoors, just loved being outside. That's what we did.
Sorry, Susan, I didn't ask you about this. How did you guys meet?
But I'm asking Mark.
Oh. We met skiing. My family, my dad and I helped friends build a small camp at Squaw Mountain in Greenville when we were kids, and it was tiny. We used to cram 8 or 10 of us in there. Called it the birdhouse. It was on stilts up in the woods. Family that he was his best friend. He grew up with in Bangor. His family later on became kids I grew up with. And a couple years after we did that, we leased them. At that time, you had to lease lots mm-hmm. going up to the mountain. We leased a lot. And when I was 15 or 16, we built a cabin there. And, by the time I was 16, my father had stopped skiing, and I pretty much had the place to myself, which was controversial in the neighborhood sometimes. We were a little wild. These kids are out of control up there. But when we were about 17, Susan started skiing with one of the friends I grew up with that we originally built the camp with. 16. We always argue about that. I say 17, she says 16. So yeah, we met up there skiing and pretty much been together ever since.
That's great.
You learned a lot from your parents. His parents didn't live a long, long time, but I think that's also affected how we lived and what we did, and we weren't trying to get that big house in the suburbs or anything anymore.
It's true. They never made it out of their 50s, and it changed my perspective on. It's kind of funny to look at it now. You see all these people with the last year of COVID talking about quitting their jobs, and, you know, I realize that time is short, and I don't want to spend my whole life in a cubicle or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I got that kind of happened to me when my parents passed so young. Realized that, you know, do what you enjoy. My dad always said that. He goes, you know, he said he worked a job that he didn't love. He always said, you know, hey, marry somebody that likes to do what you like to do. That's important. And, you know, if you're going to work, you're going to spend most of your time at your job, you probably ought to enjoy it. Mm-hmm. I see too many people that don't enjoy. Because a lot of them now at this point, they're retiring and we're not retiring. Because as one of my friends says, you retired 30 years ago.
No. Yeah. It's real work.
Yeah. Well, we have younger friends who are retiring and we were like, well, we're not retiring.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think our retirement
retirement's our friends. We're so fortunate. We have so such an incredible network of friends, probably from the river work and thing and the mountain work and things like that. But they all have the homes we go to visit and things like that, and they make us feel so welcome. And so we have that place on the lake we can go to anytime we want, or go skiing, whatever.
We're their favorite playmates a lot of times.
We put together the camping trips. The
professional players.
That all comes from our ability. We put together the camping trips. You know, we all get together, and we did that during COVID. Mm-hmm. We had between the campfires that we had and the camping trips that we did with folks. It was fun.
This is the end of our three-part series with Susan and Mark Adams. Thank you to Susan and Mark for hosting us and sharing their stories. For more glimpses of life and connections to land in Maine, look to other episodes of A Talk in the Woods, available wherever you listen to podcasts. This podcast is a product of the Maine Mountain Collaborative, which is a 501c3 nonprofit. Please consider making a donation at mainemountaincollaborative.org. I'm Lily Horn. Thanks for listening.